Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by UCAN. Perform, workout, energize. That's GenerationUCAN.com. By VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shops. By Polar, winners are made of blood, sweat, and data. By our Challenge Athletes Foundation, we sent out 3,260 grants totaling $4.8 million to keep Challenge athletes in the game of life through sport. To help out, go to ChallengedAthletes.org. And you can check out any of our interviews on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Babbittville.com. As always, endurance lives here. Our next guest from Sports Stats, Mr. Mark Roy. Mark, how you doing?
I'm doing awesome, Bob. Thanks for having me.
So, you guys, how many events are you timing around the world now?
This year, we're just going to be over 1,300 events around the world.
And how did all this start? Were you a runner, triathlon guy before you started Sports Stats?
I was athletic for sure. I was into sport, and I started doing triathlons back in 1988. And I organized a duathlon in my high school in 1990. Yeah. Ended up hiring Sports Stats in 1991. So they were just starting, small company out of Ottawa, with just a handful of events. And then I started working for them in 1992, 1993. And eventually bought the company in 1995. And back then, we were still small, about 42 events when I purchased the company.
Well, and when you talk about timing, back in the day, you probably go back far enough where you'd finish a race and someone would hand you a popsicle stick with a number on it, and they would staple it up on the board and figure out your time. I don't think there's a industry that's changed as much as the timing industry over those years. How have you adapted to all of the change?
We had to adapt quite quickly because the good thing we did is we did jump on board with the RFID technology. That was 1997, 1998 for us. So 1997, I remember timing Ironman Canada for the first time manually. So we had to push buttons and we had the little Velcro straps and we were throwing that around all day. Wow. We did our first Ironman with 2,000 athletes at Ironman Canada manually back then. So we jumped on board in 1998, and then our next Ironman was with Championship back in the day.
And was there resistance from race directors at all with, hey, we're going to try something new, because it is something new?
Yeah, a lot of them actually wanted to see other races fail. And when they did not, they decided, okay, we'll give it a try. So it took about 2 or 3 years to transition. And by 2000, I would say 95% of our races had opted for RFID technology back in the day.
And when you look at a race like Ironman, a world championship, when you're in a sort of a remote area, and back in the day, getting any type of stats out during the race day itself was really hard to figure out where athletes were. That seems to be one of the bigger changes, where people can follow their athlete pretty much all day long.
Exactly. Back in the day, I still remember doing live results, and we were running 3.5 discats from the timing computer that was sitting basically at the swim exit, for example, because we can get internet at the swim exit. So they're running diskettes back and forth between the results center. I got a funny story. This is in 2000, Ironman California, the first year. And there's an external company came and did the live results, and we had to run 1 mile to get the live results to them. So a buddy of mine, marathon runner, he's a 220 marathoner, basically ran the diskette over. And all of a sudden, he comes back and says, Mark, the times are all wrong. What do you mean? Well, nobody swims 58 minutes. It should be 50 minutes for the swim. And as we all know, that first year was a nautical mile distance instead of
I remember that because it was Brian Rhodes, I think, was first out of the water.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I remember Graham Frazier, who was the race director, it was a two-loop swim. And he went and swam the first loop a couple days before. He said, God, that seems long. And they're like, no, sir, it's exactly, the course is exactly 2.4 miles. Well, he didn't say it was nautical miles. So it was actually longer. And everybody, I think Brian was the only guy under an hour for that swim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And they ended up extending the cutoff by about 10 or 15 minutes on that day.
So when you look at those type of changes, I mean, how many timing mats do you have now over an event like the Ironman World Championship? And I remember those mats used to be these huge, bulky things that you would have to, you know, have to haul out somewhere. Now it seems like they're so much lighter and so much easier.
Yeah, it's changed quite a bit over the years. I still remember using championship and the bulky mats over the years. And because they were so bulky, because they were so expensive to ship around, we basically covered our basics. So we did the turnaround on the Lee Drive. We did the turnaround on any energy lab. We did a turnaround in Navi. And we tried our best to basically get athletes to go over those mats on the course.
Right.
And, of course, over the years, technology has improved, and now we're basically just using an active transponder. And most of the athletes will never see the timing systems on race day because it's just a wire duct taped to the ground that basically just keeps sending us data. And as the technology, especially in Kona, has improved, like the cell network has improved, it's enabled us to place more and more and more timing mats along the way.
So with athletes, one of the things you deal with world championship events like Kona is so many people coming out of the water so close together. And I'm imagining over time that race directors will sit down with you and go, I need to have some data here. How many people are coming out of the water between 55 minutes and an hour and 5 minutes? So it's like, how do we spread these people out? In terms of coming up with solutions, as people have gotten faster and faster, how have you guys been involved?
We've been involved a lot, believe it or not, especially in the last 24 months with Andrew Messick, of course,
yes.
Basically asking for that data and say, how do we find a way to spread out and basically have it so we don't end up with used draft packs? Everybody
right.
swims between 55 and an hour five, so we have 1,000 or 1,200 athletes coming out within a 10-minute gap.
Yep.
How do we spread that out? So we're able to extract that data. Basically, if we had done, let's say, 10 ways instead and reapplied that data on the same year, how will that affect the bike course? And that's where we're able to come out with some statistics and say, well, if you basically use these waves, it will automatically spread out even more just because we can estimate where people and where the peaks are going to be out of the water. So now the peak will not be, it's going to be at 55 to an hour five, but for each of those waves.
So, and by adding those waves this year, that should help with those draft packs.
It should, absolutely. Based on the statistics and information we pulled, we should be able to see a significant change on the peak coming out of the water at the same time and hopefully alleviate some of the draft packs on the course.
What's next for you guys in terms of technology, in terms of changes that you see in the whole running and endurance scene?
I know a lot of people want to see GPS technology come in, and basically we've looked at that for many, many years, and the issue is always battery life, cost of basically data and so on each of the devices. So this is something that I don't think we're going to see in the next 5-10 years coming along. The best thing is basically I think it's going to become beacon technology, where we place a beacon along the course every 3 miles or every 5 miles, for example, and the transponders talk to those beacons. So you're getting a signal from that transponder every 3 to 5 miles in the course. And we're testing that technology. Actually, I'm flying to Buenos Aires on the weekend, and we're trying that technology there again. We've tried it about 5 to 10 races with quite some good success so far. And believe it or not, we've shipped 4 boxes to Argentina 2 weeks ago, and I'm flying with the rest of the timing systems in my backpack.
Oh my. With you in your backpack, where in the
yep.
past you
in
would have
backpack,
to get a semi and put it on a cargo boat to get it over there. The equipment was so big in the past. Wow.
Yes, exactly.
And so with this beacon technology, you'll be able to get results from the course like every 3 miles?
Yeah, the idea is maybe 3 miles is almost too much data. If you look at a 112-mile bike course, especially at Kona, where it's basically out and back,
right?
If we're able to at least give you every 10 miles on the bike,
yes.
That gives you quite, like every 20, they're getting data. And, of course, we're not using GPS, but our technology is getting better and better of getting you an estimate of what time they're going to be at the next timing point. What time are they going to be at the finish of that leg? And with the new tracker that we work with RTRT and Ironman on building, it's really changed how people track. And it's really very precise as people move throughout the course. So people, spectators, can get to their locations. They're always going to come by within the next 2 or 3 minutes. And often you see that happen within 30 seconds to a minute. We don't know athletes that actually are suffering from this, slowing down. That could affect their pace, but most of the time it's very, very accurate to predict.
And so for shorter events, you potentially could use GPS.
Say again, Bob?
For a shorter event, like a shorter, like a sprint triathlon or something like that, you could use GPS.
You could, but the issue with GPS, again, is getting those 400 participants with a GPS tracker on them. The battery would last fine, but the event is so short
right.
that I'd rather simply put, let's say they're doing Olympic distance,
yep.
like we're doing next weekend, I have 6 timing mats or detection point on the bike course over a 40-kilometer distance. I don't need GPS because the tracker will basically enable us to track everybody, predict where they're going to be fairly accurately, and then we have 4 on the run course, so on a 10-kilometer course. On the shorter distance, and then again, imagine having 400 of those devices, then you have to pay a $1 or $2 or $5 SIM card fee every month, plus a data package for every one of those, and then you have to track them after the race and get them back and so on,
oh.
and charge them between events. So the GPS technology is simply not user-friendly enough to. And then you go into locations like Lake Placid, where 60% of the course has no cell coverage whatsoever.
Oh, my God. I had no idea.
In Lake Placid, for example, this year we had Facebook or Ironman Now and Facebook Watch. We had to actually knock on doors a few days before the race. We ran Cat5 cables out of libraries where we could get a connection where there was no cell service along the course.
And I think one thing people don't realize for Kona is actually a Boston Marathon qualifier.
It's one of the only certified course, and we get to export and send Boston the results right after the event every year. Correct.
Yeah, I think it was something like, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was like 140, something like that number, mm-hmm. In terms of runners last year, or one of the last couple of years, that qualified for the Boston Marathon running the Ironman Marathon course after doing a 2.4-mile swim and 112-mile bike ride.
Yeah, that is crazy.
I mean, it's what I love about that is when you're in Boston and people say, "Where'd you qualify?" And, oh, I qualified in Chicago. I qualified in New York. It's like, well, where'd you qualify? I qualified in Kona after a 2.4-mile swim and 112-mile bike ride. Started my marathon in 100-degree heat and qualified. that's a little bit of a bragging rights. And through the years, obviously, you've built a huge database of people who are getting timed through sports stats. Do you communicate with those folks? Do you have your own Facebook and
we do. We have a membership platform. We have about 100,000 members that created a sports stats account where they can simply go in, claim all the results basically, and follow other participants and so on. And again, we're one of the only timing companies that push results to sports stats only. We'll push them to Ironman and so on, but we have our own database, our own website, our own. And most of the timing companies that are out there will use a third-party service to put their results on. And once the results are on there, basically, somebody else is basically getting the advertising dollar or so on. So we've spent a lot of money over the years to basically build a system where people can come back, compare all the results since 1997 to today, basically.
Wow, so you go back that far.
And exactly.
And one of the events that you've been intimately involved with was Ironman Mont Tremblant. Which I was able to go to a couple years ago. Spectacular event. The Dom and the team up there, and I know you're involved with that event. That's close to your heart. Talk a little bit about how that event came about and how proud you are of where it's at now.
Yeah, it's an amazing event, of course. I ended up, I remember calling Dominic. This was 2010. And Ironman, of course, was looking for a new location in Canada. And we were looking at the places in Ontario near Ottawa. This is where our own base is, and in Quebec. And right away, I thought of Dominic because I've known him for about 10 years, and he's been the race director for the triathlon in Mont-Tremblant. And the venue there was simply perfect. The big issue is that they needed to repave the roads completely in order to receive an international race like this.
Right.
And I remember calling him, and then he gave me a couple of days, came back to me, and right with Mark, done deal. We got it. We're going to repave it. So within 30 to 60 days, he got a commitment from the federal and the provincial government to spend $5 to $6 million on repaving all the roads. And we ended up flying to Tampa in December 2010 to present the project. And it was really, really well. I remember the presentation. We had the mayor of the city. We had the chief of police. We had the Interwest president at the time. Dominic and I were there to present in front of WTC. And they were blown away at the time. And I remember having lunch afterwards with one of the representatives. And they asked me, would you bet your career? Would you bet this is going to work? I said, absolutely. This venue is incredible. And this is 8 years later now. And boat events are doing extremely well still.
Well, and it's three major weekends, right? Don't they do a 70.3? Is the 70.3 and the 5150 the same weekend, or they do 2 weekends or 3 weekends?
When they started, it was 2 separate weekends, and for the last 4 years or so, they've had the 5150 at the same weekend of the 70.3. So we end up having 2,000 athletes on a Saturday doing a 5150, which is at the Olympic distance, and a sprint. And then on this Sunday, we had 70.3 with 3,000 athletes. So we have almost 5,000 athletes coming on Mont-Tremblant in the third weekend of June every year, which is crazy.
And then the full is, that's the August time frame, correct?
That is correct, yeah. Around August 18th this year, next year is the 23rd, and they get right around 2,800 participants every single year, so it's a great event.
I love it. Talk about a town that is built for that event. It's spectacular. And you and I have been chatting about our Breakfast with Bob show from Kona this year and working together to get a little promo for to your folks to share a little. We'll be doing 50-plus interviews over that week, and we're talking about working together on that.
Yeah, I think we'd be very interested to partner with Breakfast with Bob and basically help promote. And I think I always build relationships that are win-win on both sides. And I think we can help promote our company and, of course, send more viewers to watch the interviews and so on.
We love that. And after my first experience at Ironman Mont-Tremblant, just understanding how close the sport is to your heart. Obviously, you guys cover running events and triathlon, but triathlon seems to be where your heart really is.
It is. I did my first Ironman distance in 1993. Did my second in 2001, and I'm turning 50 next year, so I have to do another one very soon.
Love that. And now are you? You haven't done a full since when?
20 years. So 2001 was my last Ironman Florida. And I've done a lot of Ironman 70.3 distance since, but never got the, I guess, running family, running a business and so on, the time commitment. And I think I'm ready for 2020 to get back on the saddle and do one more.
You know, what's fascinating is people ask me, hey, when are you going to do another? I haven't done one since 88. And I'm like, you know, you can fake a 70.3. You can sort of do a couple hour bike rides and get through a half marathon and... But you can't fake an Ironman. You got to do those 6-7 hour bike rides. And I'm sure you're the same as I am. When you're out there for that long, you're thinking all the other things you need to be doing.
Yeah, it's hard. And I find the running really easy because I bring my shoes everywhere. I get to run. The biking gets hard as I travel. Like, I'm on the road for the next 7 weeks.
Wow.
Basically not on and off, basically at events every single weekend. We spent a good almost 2 weeks in Kona getting ready for that one, so we fly in quite early. We do the swim the week before, and then the entire team comes in at least a week early to set up and do everything.
How many days a year do you think you're on the road?
It used to be about 150, 180, almost 50% of the year. Drop it down to about 100 days now. So I know what the amount of miles I fly every year. It used to be closer to 200,000 miles, and trying to reduce that to about 100,000 now.
Does it get old for you?
It does not. I enjoy what I do. I would not change what I do for anything. I love it.
And you get to be at that finish line. And it's funny because obviously you see a lot of people finishing and you're dealing with the logistics of the timing, etc. But there's something about those finish lines where you know that somebody's life has been changed forever. Does that ever get old?
It does not. The looks on their face and being able to see that, especially, like, I still remember the last hour in Kona last year.
Yeah.
I think the most special was that 80-plus-year-old finishing in front of us.
Yep.
That was completely, to me, butt chills, and ended up actually filming it. And every time I watch it, it kind of brings the chills back. So it never gets old.
Love it. Hey, Mark, thanks so much for taking time. It's going to be great to work with you for Breakfast with Bob in Kona. And love what you're – I love the – the passion that you bring to the table on all of this. And I love the fact that you guys are working to, hey, we've got a problem. We got a good problem. Everybody's swimming so fast that they're too close together. We got to figure out how to solve this, and you're involved with making that happen.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
All right, Mark Roy has been our guest from Sports Stats. We are brought to you by UCAN. Perform, workout, energize. That's GenerationUCAN.com. By VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop. By Polar, winners are made of blood, sweat, and data. By our Challenge Athletes Foundation, we sent out 3,260 grants totaling $4.8 million. Keep Challenge Athletes in the game of life through sport. Help out. Go to ChallengedAthletes.org, and you can check out any of our interviews. Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Babbittville.com. As always, endurance lives here.